Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 873. The New Age, Fascism, and the Atlantis Myth. This is being recorded on November 12th of the year 2015. This is in this program, and in For the Record 874, we're going to be revisiting a number of themes that we have spoken of in the past in programs, lectures, and For the Record shows, archive shows, and lectures, namely areas of overlap between some features of occult philosophy, and specifically in the next two shows, we're going to talk about the Atlantis myth and elements of fascism and Nazism. Now, I want to stress a couple of things, several points right up front, because we have a lot of material to cover. The New Age is, of course, when we're speaking of it, we're talking about a very broad brush. So I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing the New Age as fascist. Indeed, I think most of the people, probably the overwhelming majority of people who have been attracted to one aspect or another of New Age philosophy, would be anything but fascist or Nazi in their inclinations. So I want to make that point very clear and right up front. I also want to emphasize that we're going to be revisiting several concepts which we highlighted in our discussions with Peter Lavenda, For the Record programs 838 through 847, and then 864 as well. In our discussions with Peter Lavenda, we were talking about several concepts which will obtain in this program. One, the concept of weaponized religion, and specifically weaponized religion as a form of mind control. I also want to underscore another concept that Peter has discussed in the book, his landmark text, The Hitler Legacy, and that is the concept of Nazism, or perhaps we could even extend it somewhat, fascism, as a cult, as something of a religious philosophy. Also, inherent in the political mythology of Atlantis and extraterrestrial origins of the, quote, Aryan race and attendant concepts is the notion that once upon a time, things were better. We talked at some length with Peter about the concept of a mythical and idealized past being something that many aspects of fascism and many schools aligned with Nazism have emphasized. That is something that we will be talking about in our next two shows. Also, the pseudo-scientific philosophy of polygenesis will figure in here. That is the notion that the various races had different origins. It is the notion of polygenesis is inextricably linked with the concept or the outlook, the philosophy of scientific racism. And we're going to be talking about that in our next couple of programs as well. It should be noted that the studies of DNA and the evolution of the human genome are rather rigorous, and for the adherence to scientific racism or polygenesis, the findings are rather unforgiving. geneticists and anthropologists have identified an African female whom they have dubbed Eve as the very first identifiable human being. And all human beings have part of her genetic material in their genetic material as well. This is something that would certainly be rejected by scientific racism and by polygenesis, and certainly people looking to ascribe the, quote, Aryan race, unquote, and its genesis to, take your pick, Atlantis, people, aliens from outer space, what have you, you generally have to overlook the fundamentals of reality. And in fact, they have done that. So again, several concepts, because we have a lot of material to cover. I do not want to be misunderstood as characterizing the gentle adepts of the New Age as fascist, although there are prominent aspects of fascist and Nazi ideology that are present within New Age philosophy. And that is one of the reasons for doing this program, is to alert people to the implications and origins of things like the notion of Atlantis and UFOs or space aliens being the ancestors of humans. These are very dangerous concepts. I've done a lot of programs about UFOs, and the first two lectures that are available on the Spitfire website go into UFOs and some aspects of New Age philosophy. To make an extremely long story very short, people have seen a frisbee, right? That's a toy. It's a disc-shaped airfoil, and when the motive force of one's hand is applied to it, it flies. The notion that human beings, with all of their remarkable technology, could not make an aircraft that incorporated some of the features of a frisbee is just not to be believed. And also the notion that we evolved from space aliens, or that the Aryans, unquote, evolved from space aliens. As the late Carl Sagan noted, any living being, for example, any human being from Earth, would have a better chance of a successful mating with a petunia than with a life form whose nucleic acid had been formed outside of our solar system. One of the things we have spoken of in our discussions of the landmark work of Jacques Vallée is the space alien UFO myth. One of the points Vallée makes is that the notion of space aliens always involves, or almost always involves, a superior civilization. They're a million years ahead of us technologically, but their sun is dying, so they have to mate with Earth women. Some of the worst aspects of 1950s style sci-fi BS, and the notion that a superior civilization would spend many years flying through space at 186,000 miles per second, the speed of light, in order to play tag with a couple of good old boys fishing off a dock in Pascagoula, Mississippi, simply is not to be taken at face value. And again, the notion of polygenesis is inherent in the Atlantis slash UFO or esoteric Nazism myth, and that is fundamental to some of the philosophy surrounding, quote, Aryan, the notion of the Aryan race. Also, the notion of Nazism as a cult, and the philosophy or the outlook that is common to so many fascist manifestations, the notion of, well, once upon a time, things were better, and life was good, but then along came those people, and figure out, you know, who those people are, whether it's blacks or, as in most cases, the Jews, unquote. Well, these are concepts we are going to be exploring in our next two shows. We're going to begin with an article, an excerpt from an article that appeared in the New York Times of November 3rd, 2015. The article is by Ralph Blumenthal, and it was headlined in the print edition of the Times, "Built by the Ancients, Seen from Space." It reads in part, "High in the skies of a Kazakhstan, space-age technology has revealed an ancient mystery on the ground. Satellite pictures of a remote and treeless northern steppe reveal colossal earthworks, geometric figures of squares, crosses, lines, and rings the size of several football fields recognizable only from the air, and the oldest estimated at 8,000 years old. The largest near a Neolithic settlement is a giant square of 101 raised mounds, its opposite corners connected by a diagonal cross covering more terrain than the Great Pyramid of Cheops. Another is a kind of three-limbed swastika, its arms ending in zigzags bent counterclockwise." Skipping down, quote, "I don't think they were meant to be seen from the air," unquote, Mr. Dimitri Day, DEY-44, said in an interview from his hometown, Kostanay, K-O-S-T-A-N-A-Y, dismissing outlandish speculations involving aliens and Nazis. And then Blumenthal notes, "Long before Hitler, the swastika was an ancient and near-universal design element. He theorizes, Day that is, that the figures built along straight lines on elevations were, quote, horizontal observatories to track the movements of the rising sun," unquote. I suspect that many of these ancient structures were also navigational aids to help the people who built them travel around, for example, in the wintertime when roads or pathways may have been difficult to travel, or perhaps obscured by snow, or perhaps in some desert areas by sandstorms as well. However, note that these are the kind of things that what we are going to encounter and under the rubric of esoteric Nazism have attributed to the ancients having been visited by the Aryans, either from Atlantis or outer space or Hyperborea or Lemuria or some combination thereof, and they were there, therefore endowed with the ability to create these things. Eric von Däniken and his Chariots of the Gods is probably the best known of these of that genre. We're going to examine polygenesis and a city in Bolivia called Tiwanaku, and we're going to examine a fellow who was a writer and went on to become an SS officer associated with the Ananerba, and his belief that Tiwanaku was in fact built by the Aryan race who had come here from Atlantis. And this will be something of an introduction to our concept of polygenesis and scientific racism. Note that not only the Nazis, but also the European, the Bolivian elite of European origin saw their hegemony over the natives of Bolivia, a country that has the largest indigenous population of any in Latin America, as proof that they were of superior origins and that, in fact, there was no degree of continuity between their evolution and the evolution of those whom they were quite explicit as viewing as their inferiors. From the appendix.net of June 5th of 2013, the following article is by Matthew Gildner, G-I-L-D-N-E-R. It's headlined, "Andean Atlantis, Race, Science, and the Nazi Occult in Bolivia." I would note in passing that in the 1980s, Bolivia became the focal point of the activities of former SS officer Klaus Barbie and his Coca Fascisti, who set up something of a cocaine fascist government in Bolivia with considerable aid from the CIA, for whom Klaus Barbie had worked. We looked at that in a number of programs, including AFA program number 27. Now again, from Andean Atlantis, Race, Science, and the Nazi Occult in Bolivia, we read, as the train steamed around the bend, Lake Titicaca became visible far to the north. The morning sun danced on the water, and the majestic Cordillera Real towered beyond. The whistle howled, the engine lurched, and after an arduous journey from Berlin, amateur archaeologist and future SS commander Edmund Kiss, K-I-S-S, had finally reached his destination. The ruins of the ancient city-state of Tiwanaku, T-I-W-A-N-A-K-U. Tiwanaku had been an object of Western fascination since 1549, when a motley band of Spanish conquistadores encountered the ruins deep in the Andes in what is today Bolivia. Massive stone gateways, enormous granite megaliths, colossal earthworks, intricately carved stella, mysterious glyphs, the Spaniards marveled at their discovery. Asked of the origins of the ruins and the fate of the civilizations that constructed them, local indigenous caciques, or lords, stated that they were from a time long past and that their original inhabitants had been destroyed by a great flood. Its antiquity so obvious, its provenance so uncertain, Tiwanaku became one of the great mysteries of modern archaeology. During the 19th century, the ruins attracted a host of European naturalists that speculated on the civilization that built the monumental structures. Some attributed the site to ancient Egyptians, others to bearded Europeans. All agreed that the ancestors of Lake Titicaca's local peoples, the Aymara, A-Y-M-A-R-A, would have been incapable of accomplishing such a magnificent feat. But if native Andeans hadn't constructed Tiwanaku, then who had? Kiss disembarked at Tiwanaku with a bold theory. Tall and bespectacled, his face pink from the unrelenting Altiplano sun, he stood out among the Aymara porters shuffling past. Their rural, quote, uncivilized, unquote, condition only strengthened his conviction that the ruins were built a million years ago by his Aryan ancestors, an ancient Nordic race who had migrated from the lost city of Atlantis. Kiss's theory may have been strange, but stranger still was the fact that it was hardly new. For decades, Bolivians themselves had been pondering their Atlantean ancestry. In fact, for many of the same reasons that Kiss had. A connection to Atlantis empowered Bolivia's European-descended aristocracy for the very same reasons that it attracted Nazis. It gave them their own private Garden of Eden, and it reinforced the myth of white supremacy. The legend of Atlantis traces its origins to Plato, who introduced the fabled city in the dialogues Timaeus and Critias, C-R-I-T-I-A-S. Timaeus, T-I-M-A-E-U-S. Plato told of an advanced island civilization beyond the Pillars of Hercules that was ruled by a remarkable dynasty of kings, unquote, endowed with unimaginable wealth. The kings, having grown overzealous, set out to conquer Athens and enslave its peoples. The Athenians mobilized a heroic defense, but the conflict angered the gods. They sent earthquakes and floods, and Atlantis was, quote, swallowed up by the sea and vanished, unquote. Classicists have long maintained that Atlantis was a fable that the ancient philosopher invented to warn of the arrogance of power. Over the centuries, however, Plato's legend acquired an air of truth. During the Renaissance, tales of Atlantis circulated in the European imagination, born on humanist inquiry and the discovery of the Americas. 16th century Spanish chroniclers, from Bartolomé de las Casas to Francisco López de Gomara, drew parallels between the New World and Plato's Lost City, as did Francis Bacon and Thomas More of Great Britain. For French scholars who believed that humans had multiple origins, Atlantis evidenced the existence of man before Adam. But it was during the late 19th century that interest in the fabled lost city exploded. A Minnesota politician and amateur antiquarian named Ignatius Donnelly, D-O-N-N-E-L-L-Y, is widely credited for the Atlantis revival in the 19th century. In 1882, his bestseller, Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, didn't just argue that Plato's Atlantis existed, it claimed that Atlantis had shaped other ancient cultures, from the Maya to the Egyptians. Popular and scientific interest in Atlantis flourished. The Royal Geographic Society of London and the U.S. National Geographic Society were soon sponsoring research on the lost city's location and funding quixotic and at times unnecessarily deadly expeditions. It's often overlooked that this Atlantis revival coincided with the apogee of polygenesis, one of the fundamental assumptions of scientific racism. Polygenesis was an alternative theory of evolution that rejected the common origins of humans, a belief rooted in Christian creationism and sustained by Darwinian evolution. Polygenists divided humans into separate biological species or races that each originated and evolved independently. Races were classified according to innate, inheritable physical attributes, that is, not just skin color, but cranial capacity. Locating those origins, however, was more complicated. If darker-skinned peoples originated in Africa, as polygenists had long assumed, then where did the lighter-skinned people come from? Atlantis would provide 19th-century polygenists with their own private Garden of Eden, an idea that appealed especially to Bolivia's Creole or European descendant elite. Since securing their independence from Spain in 1825, they governed, often precariously, the most indigenous country in the hemisphere. Polygenesis provided irrefutable scientific proof of their biological difference and social superiority over native Andean peoples. And deployed alongside the Atlantis myth, it allowed them to claim Tiwanaku as a source of Creole heritage. 20 kilometers southeast of Lake Titicaca on the high plateau straddling Peru and Bolivia, Tiwanaku was once the administrative and ceremonial center of a vast Andean Empire. Stratigraphic excavations carried out by Wendell Bennett in the 1930s indicated that the civilization emerged as early as 300 BCE and reached its apex between 600 and 800 AD. Radiocarbon dating subsequently confirmed its age, and archaeologists today generally agree that Tiwanaku was built by the ancestors of the Aymara-speaking peoples who populate the Lake Titicaca Basin today. Such a claim was laughable in the Bolivia of Belisario Diaz Romero, R-O-M-E-R-O. Born in La Paz in 1870 to a wealthy family of Spanish provenance, Diaz belonged to an elite class of statesmen and intellectuals that reaped enormous profits by exporting natural resources and exploiting the indigenous labor. The republic they governed was overwhelmingly made up of Native Americans, largely Aymara and Quechua, Q-U-E-C-H-U-A, speaking peoples in the highlands and valleys of the eastern Andean escarpment. Creole wealth rested on their access to indigenous labor, their social privilege, and political legitimacy rested on a shared conviction that indigenous Bolivians belonged to an inferior race. Among the Creole gentlemen scholars who shored up such beliefs Diaz stood apart. He practiced medicine, wrote history, experimented with botany, and studied geography, linguistics, and archaeology. He was a member of the Geographic Society of La Paz, the National Institute of Statistics, and the National Academy of History. He directed the Meteorological Observatory and the National Museum. Sharp, yet soft-spoken, he was the last of Bolivia's great polymaths. That's P-O-L-Y-M-A-T-H-S. His most original contribution to Bolivian science was in evolutionary biology. Diaz vehemently rejected creationism and was an early proponent of natural selection. Yet he dismissed Darwin's belief in the common origins of the human species, embracing instead the polygenic theories of leading French and German biologists. He divided the human species into three living and permanent races, the white race, the yellow race, and the black race, unquote. Homo Niger, or the black race, originated in Africa, and Homo Atlanticus in Asia, A-T-L-A-I-C-U-S. Homo Atlanticus was a white, ancient Aryan race that came from Atlantis. Diaz attributed the construction of the monumental architecture of Tiwanaku to Homo Atlanticus. 200 million years ago, the ancient Aryans migrated west to South America from the original Atlantis across a long, lost land bridge. They settled in the Bolivian Altiplano, which was much different back then. Lake Titicaca was three times larger, and the surrounding plain was not windswept and barren. It was lush and tropical, ideal for farming and abundant in natural resources. Homo Atlanticus settled in a shallow valley on the southern shore of the lake, where they constructed a magnificent city. Diaz not only revealed the origins of the ruins, but explained their supposed contrast with Bolivia's present-day indigenous population. By measuring skulls, he argued that the cranial measurements of Bolivian Indians were not consistent with those of Homo Atlanticus. Rather, the Aymara were descendants of Homo Atlanticus, barbaric Asians who arrived in a later migration. It was Homo Atlanticus that conquered the ancient city and named it Tiwanaku. Diaz's, quote, discoveries, unquote, were well received in the elite scientific and political circles of Fin de Siècle La Paz, so well received, in fact, that the government promoted Tiwanaku as the official icon of Bolivia's centennial celebrations in 1925. The months leading up to Independence Day were marked by the typical flourish of statues, monuments, and nationalist speeches. The streets were cleaned, and the Parisian townhouses lining the stately Calle Montes were repainted. The president even issued a supreme decree prohibiting Indians from sidewalks and plazas. And when the big day finally came, Creole aristocrats could raise their glass in the name of the Republic and toast their ancient ancestors from Tiwanaku, the, quote, primitive metropolis of South American whites, unquote. Whether or not the German writer Edmund Kiss met Diaz Romero during his stay in Bolivia remains uncertain. But Kiss was undoubtedly exposed to his ideas by Arthur Posnansky, P-O-S-N-A-N-S-K-Y, a swashbuckling Austrian capitalist, amateur archaeologist, and international gentleman of science. Tiwanaku was Posnansky's enduring obsession. From 1903, the year he settled in Bolivia, to his death in 1946, he published over 130 titles on the site in four different languages. What brought Kiss and Posnansky together, and what drew Kiss to Tiwanaku in the first place, was Kiss's commitment to German ethnic nationalism and his obsession with the mythic past. Neither were uncommon in the Weimar Republic. As the Nazi Party expanded during the 1920s and 1930s, right-wing romantic nationalists celebrated an idealized folk culture as the essence of German nationhood. Though the Nazis didn't come up with the idea of a pure Aryan race, they did invest manpower and invent new knowledge to fill in its history and evolution. Kiss and his fellow Nazi ideologues had a particular weakness for Atlantis. Like Diaz Romero, they too believed that Caucasians had originated in the Lost City. The Nazis took the polygenic fantasy a step further, however, subdividing whites into Semites, the ancestors of the Jews, and Aryans, an ancient race autochthonous to Northern Europe. It's autochthonous to Northern Europe. The Aryan-Atlantis connection occupied a central place in Nazi mysticism and was one of the most popular themes of German science fiction during the 1920s and 1930s. Where archaeological evidence of Aryan Atlanteans was lacking, an elaborate theory called glacier cosmology did the trick. A moon had once collided with Earth, destroying Atlantis and covering the planet with glaciers. What led Kiss to Tiwanaku was his belief that following the cataclysm, survivors of that ancient Nordic civilization took refuge in the high Andes, one of the few places where life was still possible. Kiss found Poznanski while researching the question, and in 1928, he set off to Bolivia to study the ruins. Kiss spent almost a year at Tiwanaku, although always wearing the same long white smock and Panama hat, he carefully surveyed the ruins and their relative position to the sun, stars, and moon. Kneeling notepad on thigh, he studied the glyphs for meaning, sometimes for hours, seeking clues to the identity of the ancient architects. Day after day, in the basement of the National Museum, he studied skulls, wondering if the ancient Tiwanakan's elongated crania were artificially deformed or belonged to a superior Nordic race. Back in Germany, his work was a wild success. Quote, "The works of art and the architectural style of the prehistoric city are certainly not of Indian origin," Kiss had concluded. Quote, "Rather, they are probably the creations of Nordic men who arrived in the Andean highlands as representatives of a special civilization," unquote. Kiss further publicized his finding with a popular tertiary of science fiction novels that chronicled the rise, decline, and ultimate triumph of the ancient Aryans. Nazi officials seized on Kiss's work and featured the ancient Nordic city of Tiwanaku in party newspapers and Hitler Youth publications. Kiss was soon put in touch with Heinrich Himmler, leader of the Nazi SS and a principal architect of the Holocaust. In 1935, Himmler had founded a new SS think tank called the Annenerbe, A-H-N-E-N-E-R-B-E, to conduct social scientific research into the history of the Aryan peoples. So far, he had sent archaeological missions to Scandinavia, France, Tibet, and Antarctica in search of the ancient origins of the Aryan race. Now, Himmler wanted Kiss to lead a trip to Bolivia, to Tiwanaku, the ancient Nordic civilization in the Andes. Working for much of 1938 and 1939, Kiss assembled a crack team of Nazi scientists for the job. Their objective? Reveal the presence of the master race in historic South America and dispel once and for all the mystery surrounding the Tiwanaku ruins. The expedition never happened. When Hitler invaded Poland in September of 1939, the war took precedence. Kiss, already an officer in the SS, was dispatched to Warsaw in Poland and then took command of Rufschanze, one of Hitler's military headquarters in East Prussia. In 1945, he surrendered to the Allies and was imprisoned alongside other Nazi war criminals. At the denazification hearings, Kiss was initially classified as a major offender, unquote, but he pleaded for and won the lesser status of fellow traveler, unquote, on account of his archaeological research. He remained committed to his Atlantis Tiwanaku thesis until his death in 1960. Like Kiss, Diaz and Poznanski also died long ago, and their fantastic interpretations of Tiwanaku have since been thoroughly discredited. Nonetheless, their legacy lives on. Popular television series like Ancient Aliens and Secrets of the Dead continue to explore the Tiwanaku-Atlantis connection. Best-selling books by Eric von Daniken and Graham Hancock go further, attributing the construction of Tiwanaku to ancient extraterrestrial beings. Though it may be hard to stomach, the survival of the Atlantis myth is certainly not surprising. Plato's lost city has proven both timeless and universal in the Western imagination. Its timelessness lies in its capacity to reveal the mysteries of human origins, its universal appeal in its unlimited imaginary potential. And, lest we forget, the legend of Atlantis evolved alongside dangerous theories of race that reinforced white supremacy for Aryan nationalists and Bolivian Creoles alike. Attributing the construction of Tiwanaku to ancient extraterrestrials only perpetuates this nefarious myth. When we wonder if Tiwanaku was built by Atlanteans or by aliens, those assumptions are based on the same twisted logic that drove men like Diaz, Poznanski, and Kiss, that Andean peoples could not have built Tiwanaku. And that is the greatest myth of all. Indeed, I think that article accurately sums up what is inherent in the notion of polygenesis, Atlantis, the extraterrestrial origins of the, quote, Aryan race, unquote. And we're going to see how those themes have been incorporated into other aspects of what has been termed esoteric Nazism. What we're going to do now is to excerpt the Wikipedia post or article about esoteric Nazism, and we're going to examine someone who, again, we discussed in our visits with Peter Lavenda, and that is a fellow named Miguel Serrano, a Chilean Nazi, his last name, S-E-R-R-A-N-O. And I would note, in the philosophy that we're going to detail here, many of the points that are made may seem altogether opaque to members of the audience. Indeed, what this is a fusion of politics with mythology, and then the casting of that fusion as scientific theory. So if I'm talking about Lemuria or Hyperborea or whatever, if that doesn't immediately resonate with you, don't worry about it, okay? And again, Miguel Serrano, someone we spoke about with Peter Lavenda, and some of his philosophy was culled from a fellow named Julius Evola, E-V-O-L-A, an Italian-born fascist philosopher who worked very closely with the SS and whom we have discussed in some of our visits with Kevin Coogan, the author of the landmark text Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Post-War Fascist International, one of the best and most important books ever written about fascism, a must-read for anyone serious about studying the political phenomenon of fascism. From Wikipedia's Esoteric Nazism article, we skip down and read about Miguel Serrano. The next major figure in esoteric Hitlerism is Miguel Serrano, a former Chilean diplomat. Author of numerous books, including The Golden Ribbon, Esoteric Hitlerism, and Adolf Hitler, The Last Avatar, Serrano is one of a number of Nazi esotericists who regard the Aryan blood, unquote, as originally extraterrestrial. Serrano finds mythological evidence for the extraterrestrial origins of man in the Nephilim, the fallen angels of the book of Genesis. Serrano suggests that the sudden appearance of Cro-Magnon man with his high artistic and cultural achievements in prehistoric Europe records the passage of one such Divya, D-I-V-Y-A, descended race alongside the abysmal inferiority of Neanderthal man, an abomination and manifest creation of the Demiurge, D-E-M-I-U-R-G-E. Of all the races on Earth, the Aryans alone preserve the memory of their divine ancestors in their noble blood, which is still mingled with the light of the black sun. All other races are the progeny of the Demiurge's beast men, native to the planet. Serrano supports this idea from various myths which assign divine ancestry to, quote, Aryan, unquote, peoples, and even the Aztec myth of Quetzalcoatl descending from Venus. He also cites the entirely respectable but not widely accepted scientific hypothesis of Bal Gandagar Tilak on the Arctic homeland of the Indo-Aryans as his authority for identifying the earthly center of the Aryan migrations with the lost Arctic continent of Hyperborea. But it's B-A-L-G-A-N-G-A-D-H-A-R, another word, T-I-L-A-K. Continuing, thus, Serrano's extraterrestrial gods are also identified as Hyperboreans. In attempting to raise the spiritual development of the earthbound races, the Hyperborean Devas, a Sanskrit term for god-men, suffered a tragic setback. Expanding on the story from the Book of Enoch, Serrano laments that a renegade group among the gods committed miscegenation with the terrestrial races, thus diluting the light-bearing blood of their benefactors and diminishing the level of divine awareness on the planet Earth. The concept of Hyperborea has a simultaneously racial and mystical meaning for Serrano. He believes that Hitler was in Shambhala, an underground center in Antarctica, formerly at the North Pole and Tibet, where he was in contact with the Hyperborean gods and from whence he would someday emerge with a fleet of UFOs to lead the forces of light, the Hyperboreans sometimes associated with Vril, over the forces of darkness, inevitably including for Serrano the Jews who followed Jehovah in a last battle, and thus inaugurating a Fourth Reich. The black sun emblem representing the celestial homeland of the Hyperboreans and the invisible source of their energy, according to Serrano. Serrano, however, has not identified the black sun with the above ornament in the Wewelsburg Castle in Germany, according to Nicholas Goodrich Clark. Quote, Serrano follows the Gnostic tradition of the Cathars. As medieval dualists, these 11th century heretics had repudiated Jehovah as a false god and mere artificer opposed to the real God far beyond our earthly realm. This Gnostic doctrine clearly carried dangerous implications for the Jews. As Jehovah was the tribal deity of the Jews, it followed that they were devil worshippers. By casting the Jews in the role of the children of Satan, the Cathar heresy can elevate anti-Semitism to the status of a theological doctrine backed by a vast cosmology. If the Hyperborean Aryans are the archetype and blood descendants of Serrano's Devias from the Black Sun, then the archetype of the Lord of Darkness needed a counter-race. The Demiurge sought and found the most fitting agent for its archetype in the Jews. As religious scholars Frederick C. Grant and Chaim Maccoby, M-A-C-C-O-B-Y, emphasize, in the view of the dualistic, of the dualist Gnostic, quote, Jews were regarded as the special people of the Demiurge and as having the special historical role of obstructing the redemptive work of the high God's emissaries, unquote. Serrano thus considered Hitler as one of the greatest emissaries of this high god, rejected and crucified by the tyranny of the Judaicized rabbis like previous revolutionary lightbringers. Serrano had a special place in his ideology for the SS, who, in their quest to recreate the ancient race of Aryan godmen, he thought were above morality and therefore justified after the example of the anti-humanitarian detached violence, unquote, taught in the Aryo-Hindu Bhagavad Gita. In the book Black Sun, Nicholas Goodrich Clark reports how Carl Gustav Jung described, quote, Hitler as possessed by the archetype of the collective Aryan unconscious and could not help obeying the commands of an inner voice. In a series of interviews between 1936 and 1939, Jung characterized Hitler as an archetype, often manifesting itself to the complete exclusion of his own personality. Quote, Hitler is a spiritual vessel, a demi-divinity, even better, a myth. Benito Mussolini is a man, the Messiah of Germany who teaches the virtue of the sword. The voice he hears is that of the collective unconscious of his race, unquote. Jung's suggestion that Hitler personified the collective Aryan unconscious deeply interested and influenced Miguel Serrano, who later concluded that Jung was merely psychologizing the ancient, sacred mystery of archetypal possession by the gods, independent metaphysical powers that ruled over their respective races and occasionally possess their members. A similar esoteric thesis is also put forward by Michael Moynihan in his book, Lords of Chaos. The writings of Miguel Serrano, Savitri Devi, and other proponents of esoteric Nazism have spawned numerous later works connecting Aryan master race beliefs and Nazi escape scenarios with enduring conspiracy theories about hollow earth civilizations and shadowy new world orders. Since 1945, since 1945, neo-Nazi writers have also proposed Shambhala and the star Aldebaran, A-L-D-E-B-A-R-A-N as in Nancy, as the original homeland of the Aryans. The book Arctos, The Polar Myth in Science, Symbolism, and Nazi Survival by scholar Jocelyn Godwin discusses pseudoscientific theories about surviving Nazi elements in Antarctica. Arctos is noted for its scholarly approach and examination of many sources currently unavailable elsewhere in English language translations. Godwin and other authors such as Nicholas Goodrich Clark had discussed the connections between esoteric Nazism and real DLIL energy, the hidden Shambhala and Agartha civilizations, and underground UFO bases, as well as Hitler's and the SS's supposed survival in underground Antarctic oases in New Swabia, or in alliance with the Hyperboreans from the subterranean world. Organizations such as the Armanen Orden represent significant developments of neo-pagan esotericism and Aryosophy after World War II, but they do not all constitute forms of Nazi esotericism. Some Northern European neo-pagan groups, such as the Theods and two others I'm not going to attempt to pronounce, have explicitly stated that neo-Nazism is not common among their members. On the other hand, there are neo-pagan organizations with close ties to neo-Nazism, such as the Artegemeinschaft or the Heathen Front, and the attraction of many neo-Nazis to Germanic paganism remains an issue, particularly in Germany. There is a contemporary loose network of small musical groups that combine neo-fascism and Satanism. These groups can be found in Britain, France, and New Zealand under names such as Black Order or Infernal Alliance and draw their inspirations from the esoteric Hitlerism of Miguel Serrano. These groups advocate the anti-modern neo-tribalism and traditionalism found in the pagan mystical ideals of Alain de Benoist's Nouvelle Droite inspired by Julius Evola. Esoteric themes, including references to artifacts such as the Spear of Longinus, are also often alluded to in neo-Nazi music, such as Rock Against Communism, and above all, in National Socialist Black Metal. And from the Wikipedia article about Miguel Serrano, a little bit about his history. In late 1941, Serrano was introduced to a Chilean esoteric order founded by F.K., a German immigrant to Chile, which claimed allegiance to a mysterious and far-flung Brahmin elite centered in the Himalayas. This mystical martial order practiced ritual magic, including tantric and kundalini yoga linked to Nietzschean concepts of the will to power and fascist activism. Serrano was initiated into the order in February of 1942. Cult members regarded Adolf Hitler as a savior of the Indo-European or Aryan race. The order considered astral projection and other higher states of awareness as the natural ancestral heritage of all pure-blooded, twice-born Aryans. The order's master described Hitler as an initiate, a being of boundless and unprecedented willpower, a bodhisattva who had voluntarily incarnated on Earth in order to overcome the Kali Yuga. He claimed to have been in astral contact with Hitler not only during the war, but also after it ended, sure evidence that he was alive and had survived the Berlin bunker, unquote. Convinced by these revelations and prompted also by popular speculations as to Hitler's survival in Antarctica, Serrano accompanied the Chilean Army and Navy on their expedition to Antarctica in 1947 and 48 in the capacity of a journalist. The stark and lonely wastes of the polar region left a permanent impression on Serrano's mind. He made his first visit to Europe in 1951, still obsessed by the enigmatic figure of Hitler. Serrano visited and brooded over the ruins of the Berlin bunker, Spandau prison, and the ruins of Hitler's Berghof in Bavaria. In Switzerland, he met and befriended Hermann Hesse, the well-known Nobel Prize-winning German romantic writer, and C.G. Jung. Jung's pre-war psychoanalysis of Hitler being a, quote, spiritual vessel, a demi-divinity, a myth, unquote, and an embodiment of the, quote, collective unconscious of his race, unquote, greatly influenced Serrano's worldview. He and Jung passionately exchanged thoughts on the meaning of mythology and archetypes in the modern age of dehumanizing mass technology. These encounters with Hesse and Jung culminated in Serrano's most famous and prestigious book, C.G. Jung and Hermann Hesse, A Record of Two Friendships. And then the entry goes on to discuss Serrano's links with or visitations with the Dalai Lama. Recall that the Himalayas was supposedly the one of the points of origin or residences, so to speak, of the, quote, Aryan race, the Hyperboreans, what have you. And again, not only in For the Record 547, but in some of our visits with Peter Lavenda, we have discussed at considerable length of the Dalai Lama and the SS Annamaerba expedition to Tibet. And we've also noted that after the Chinese invasion of and conquest of Tibet, the Dalai Lama then developed some of his SS connections into a collaboration with elements of Western intelligence. And again, Serrano had actually met with Adolf Hitler. Met with the Dalai Lama, pardon me. I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing the New Age as fascist. However, when one removes things like explicit references to the Aryan race or to the Jews or to Hitler or to Nazism, you will find a disturbingly significant area of overlap between the root concepts of esoteric Nazism and the Atlantis myth with elements of New Age philosophy. So much of the so-called New Age does talk about extraterrestrial space aliens, origins of the human race being somewhere in the stars, take your pick, the Pleiades or what have you, and also talks about space aliens being in contact with human beings and bequeathing their secrets to them. There also is a fair amount of bogus pseudo-archaeology that depicts many of the remarkable ruins that were built by ancient races and basically dehumanizes those races, or the authors, the actual creators of those ruins, by saying, well, these were obviously built by aliens, and these are proof of an ancient civilization that came from outer space and visited Earth people, blah, 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 blah. I was listening to a talk show run by a couple of people on one of the stations at which I work, and they were going on and on. In fact, they frequently have guests talking about various ruins in Africa or the pyramids or Latin America that obviously came from outer space and are the products of our brothers in space, who were the true sources of the origin of humanity. I remember in particular they had one person on going on and on about the wonderful vibrations he was able to sense at Machu Picchu and the pyramids of Egypt and other places. Those edifices, very remarkable in their engineering specifics, were not only built with slave labor, but at Machu Picchu, human sacrifice was practiced. Basically, living sacrificial victims had their hearts cut out while they were still alive. And in Egypt, the slaves who built the pyramids, the slaves who were used as labor to build the pyramids, were then entombed alive with the pharaohs whose pyramids they had helped to build. I wonder if these the good vibrations that this fellow was digging up, were those of the slaves who built these institutions? Were they the good vibrations of the slaves who were entombed alive in the pyramids? Or were these the good vibrations coming from the sacrificial victims who were having their hearts cut out? Again, the point I'm making is that it is a bunch of fresh fertilizer. And again, I think it's important to remember that so many of the people that are attracted to the New Age are not fascist or Nazi at all, but in fact are of a very opposite orientation. And yet, because they can be so easily and fundamentally misled, they can be seduced by a philosophy and a world outlook that is in itself not only fascist, but under the right circumstances could give rise to genocide. Because if some of us, according to polygenesis, are of extraterrestrial / Atlantean / Aryan / Hyperborean / Lemurian origins, and some of us aren't, well, obviously, some of us are superior to others in a world that is becoming increasingly crowded, that could be very devastating indeed. This concludes For the Record program number 723, Fascism, the New Age, and the Atlantis Myth. This is being recorded on November 12th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.